When he had performed the last operation of the evening, Zeku at once began to attend to patients who had been waiting for a consultation, although he had been either on his feet or resting briefly against a high stool for over 3 hours. To some of his patients, he gave what looked like acupuncture jabs with a very large needle, like a knitting needle, prodding at great speed into various parts of the neck and back, with impressive self-assurance and quite alarming violence. To another patient, a smartly dressed man with a neat black moustache, he gave a frightening display of bone manipulation. Locking his arms round the man's neck, he gave it a violent upward wrench, almost lifting the man from the floor. An unarmed combat specialist has told me that this is similar to one of the easier ways to kill a man in a few seconds. Next, Zeku stood back to back with the man, grabbed his arms over his head and jerked himself forward, so that the startled man was lifted into a horizontal position in the air. Instead of subsequently crumpling into a heap on the floor as I feared he might, the man merely straightened his tie, smiled and walked out of the room. This performance alone satisfied me that Zeku had unusual abilities, and had given a display of healing methods that no layman would dare attempt in public. But I could naturally not feel fully satisfied until I had good evidence of what went on behind those raised sheets. After many inquiries, I got what I wanted, an eyewitness account of a genuine surgical intervention by a fully qualified doctor, who agreed to describe her experience with Zeku on condition that I did not reveal her name. Dr. S. was a young graduate from one of Brazil's leading medical faculties, who subsequently completed a postgraduate course in psychiatry and opened her own clinic. She had a whole wall of framed diplomas, including that of membership of the São Paulo Association of Spiritist Medicine. She was also a medium, and therefore interested in psychic surgery from both sides, so to speak. She was one of the very few people outside Zeku's own circle of helpers, who won't talk to strangers, who have seen him at work from the other side of the raised sheet. The operation she watched took place in a private house in São Paulo on a Saturday afternoon in May 1973. Dr. S., a friend of the patient's family, was present along with 5 or 6 other people of good social standing. As a medium, she was asked to sit at the table and help provide the necessary current by prayer and concentration. I sat at the table with my back to the couch where the patient was lying, she told me as we sat in her clinic one hot November afternoon. I couldn't see anything, of course, because I had my eyes closed like all the others at the table. But now and then I would sort of squint around to see what was going on. I could see a normal tray of surgical equipment, including a pair of Trojanta scissors, that's a type of surgical scissors for cutting through cartilage and small bones. And at one stage I could clearly hear the sound of this instrument being used. I became quite alarmed, and finally I turned my head right round and looked. The assistants were holding the sheet up, so that I couldn't see anything, but Zeku saw me and asked what was the matter. I told him that as a doctor I felt I had an obligation to know what was happening, and asked if I could come round and watch, because I simply could not concentrate properly at the table. He said I could, and at once I got up and went to stand right beside him. I looked down at the patient, a man of 38 who had been diagnosed as suffering from a heart condition, and I saw that an incision about 15 centimeters long had been made right down his costal edge. Then Zeku just separated the flesh and plunged both his hands inside, or rather just his fingers, and began to manipulate quite violently. Then he took a pair of pincers and pulled out a piece of tissue, which he dropped into a metal container. Next, he simply pressed the two sides of the opening together, that's the only way I can describe it, and the skin just closed up. Zeku took a roll of plaster and was about to bandage the man's chest when I asked if I could have a closer look at the scar. He let me do this, and I clearly saw a reddish line exactly corresponding to where I had seen the chest open. At one stage I remember the patient seemed to be in pain, and Zeku immediately told the mediums at the table that they must concentrate harder, and say the Lord's Prayer out loud to help him. Were you completely satisfied that Zeku really opened the man's body? I asked Dr. S. Satisfied as a doctor, not only as a medium and a spiritist, completely, she replied without hesitation. The room was well lit by natural light, and I was only a few feet away like this. She opened her arms to indicate a space of about a yard. And that was not all he did. Right at the end of the session, for instance, when the atmosphere was quite normal, with nobody at the table praying or anything like that, a man went up to Zeka and showed him a nevus. That's a sort of birthmark about 1 centimeter long and at least half a centimeter wide at the base, just over the nipple of his left breast. Zeka laughed and said it wasn't anything very serious, but he would take it off if the man wanted him to. Then he picked up a scalpel and just slashed it off in one stroke, and put his thumb over the stump for a few seconds. When he took it away there was no sign of bleeding at all, although a cut like that should need several stitches. Under normal conditions, what he did would have been absolutely impossible. 6. Maria. Every psychic surgeon I came across seemed to bring a personal touch to the profession. Some used ordinary equipment, some used kitchen knives, others used their bare hands. The woman known simply as Maria introduced a refinement that even I, with 2 years' experience in the field when I first met her, had never imagined possible. She did what I am sure no other surgeon in the history of medicine has ever done. She did her operations with her eyes tightly closed. I had heard various accounts of Maria's work before I was able to see it for myself. Some witnesses were impressed, others not. All agreed that she was a very pleasant woman, and that she neither sought publicity nor had any particular objections to being watched on the job by serious researchers. As far as her technique was concerned, it seemed she went through all the right motions when operating, using ordinary surgical equipment, but she had the disconcerting habit of preferring to work in dim light, with an assistant holding a sheet between patient and spectator, as I had observed in the case of Zeka. A former patient of hers described his feelings to me at the time of operation, but these amounted to no more than a tickling sensation on the skin. He was supposed to be having a mitral valve transplant, and we agreed that this sensation should not be too difficult to produce, with nothing either psychic or even surgical involved. Another witness told me that Maria had put her hand in the pocket of her white coat and produced a pill, telling him it had just been materialized for him. I do not like psychic surgeons who put their hands in pockets, and on the whole I heard very little about Maria that sounded very encouraging. Moreover, a few days before I was due to visit the Spiritist Center where she was working, I had received a letter from Dr. Eric J. Dingwall, the most experienced psychical researcher of his day, the very mention of whose name must have struck terror into the hearts of false mediums throughout the world for over 50 years. Surely you must realize by now that many of the stories about these surgeons are sheer nonsense, he had written to me, leading me to suppose that stories I had been sending him about my own experiences were likely to prove equally nonsensical. I should add here that Ding, as he liked to be known, later became a good friend as well as my severest critic. Accordingly, it was in my best debunking frame of mind that I went along to see Maria, in the company of the same sharp-eyed and refreshingly skeptical colleague who had been with me on my visit to Zeka. The boards creaked as we climbed the old staircase leading to the first floor Spiritist Center, one of the oldest established in Sao Paulo, only a few blocks from the main banking district. This center had a reputation for sticking closely to traditional Kardecism and for its charitable work among the poor. The meeting had already begun when we arrived. There were about 100 people in the main room, seated in rows of wooden chairs facing the long white-covered table where the mediums were sitting. A man was reading from the Gospel of St. Matthew, after which another medium made a little impromptu speech interpreting it and commenting on the theme for the evening, which was turn the other cheek. Next, the spirits were invited to say a few words, as is usual at such meetings, and two or three of the mediums duly obliged. One exhorted us to love each other in such stentorian tones that I feared she was about to pelt us all with rotten bananas. She calmed down, however, wishing us all the peace of God, which was quite welcome by then, whereupon the lady announced that Dona Maria would now attend to patients in the other room. Maria got up from the head of the table and left the room. She was a kindly looking woman of about 50, with a dark complexion. She reminded me of the old-fashioned type of village postmistress in England, who always had time for a friendly chat while she weighed out your 4 ounces of chocolate drops. I had made arrangements beforehand to be allowed to watch an operation as a student of parapsychology, a phrase that tends to impress spiritists but also to make them slightly suspicious, since in Brazil the word parapsychology unfortunately became identified in spiritist circles with the antics of the Jesuit priest Father Oscar Quevedo and his organization. The Latin American Parapsychology Council, known by its Portuguese acronym CLAP, a chief aim of which appeared to be to discredit spiritism. Maria greeted us on her way into the surgery. We had met very briefly a day or two earlier to make the appointment, and asked us to wait until we were called. We did so, sitting on a long bench in the corridor, in the company of the first patient of the evening. This was a mentally retarded boy who was wailing incessantly in his father's arms, the most pathetic little creature imaginable, to whom it seemed the pleasures of normal life would be denied as long as he lived. I was impressed by the willingness with which Brazilian spiritists will try and help even the most desperate cases. After a few minutes, the father was called inside. The little boy gave me a blank stare that chilled me to the bones and wailed even louder as he passed us. Almost immediately, it seemed, he came out again, and whatever Maria had done to him had certainly quietened him down, for he left without a further sound as his father carried him gently down the old staircase and out into the street. That was an encouraging start to the evening's healing work. A man stuck his head round the door and nodded at us. He seemed very unwilling to let us in, only doing so at Maria's own request. We had only been given the appointment in the first place because of my friend's position as volunteer medium at the São Paulo Spiritist Federation. Putting on my best devout and spiritual expression, I tiptoed through the waiting room and into the surgery at the back. It was a clean, orderly room about 10 by 15 feet, furnished only with a large wall shelf stocked with ordinary-looking medicines, a small table containing a few packets of cotton wool, some small bottles and a tray of surgical instruments, and a single bed. The new patient was already lying on the bed, a sheet pulled up to her chin. She was an attractive woman of about 35, her dark hair neatly set, who was staring at the ceiling in that state of preoperative tension I knew so well from my experiences, to be described in the next chapter. Two assistants stood by the bed, one at the head and the other with her back to me. Maria was on the other side of the bed, with her back to the plain wall, out of reach of either the shelf or the table. She was bending over the patient, massaging her neck gently with both hands. She showed no sign of recognizing me, although we had exchanged greetings less than 10 minutes previously. "Come on, woman," I thought to myself somewhat impatiently. "Do your stuff, whatever it is. Fix the thoughts on Jesus, please," one of the assistants said sternly, without looking at me. I did so, though keeping my eyes determinedly fixed on the patient's throat. The room was lit by the bright light coming through the open door that led from the waiting room. It would have been light enough to read 12-point type by, and there was no difficulty in seeing everything in the room. Had I stretched out my left arm, I could easily have touched the woman's throat with my fingertips. I had a perfect view of nothing worth seeing, at any rate not yet. Maria simply went on rubbing the woman's neck, saying nothing, occasionally throwing handfuls of invisible matter into an equally invisible receptacle. "Oh dear," I thought, "it's one of these invisible jobs." I had been so intent upon watching the patient's neck and Maria's hands that I had not even glanced at the latter's face. When I did so, I had the first surprise of the evening. Maria had removed her spectacles. Her face was screwed up and her eyes were tightly closed. Next, Maria asked for a piece of cotton wool, which one of the assistants handed her, pulling it from a box beside me. Then she took a pair of scissors in her right hand, holding the sheet up with her left hand a few inches above the patient's left side, the side farthest from where I was standing. She made some brief cutting motions, then put down the scissors, took the cotton wool and pressed it on the neck, handing it back at once to the assistant. There was a bright red blob in the middle of it. I gave a start. There must be something hidden under the sheet. As if reading my thoughts, Maria immediately drew back the sheet, folding it back on itself at about the level of the patient's bust to reveal what I was afraid I was going to see, a completely unmistakable hole in the patient's neck, on the lower part of it just to the left of the windpipe. The hole was about the size of a silver dollar in circumference, and it was partly full of dark liquid. I edged a little closer, nobody making any attempt to stop me. I stared at the hole for a good 20 seconds. It was a hole, and it contained liquid. I was close enough, and the light was good enough for there to be no doubt whatsoever. It was a hole, period. Pincers, Maria ordered in a gruff voice. An assistant passed them over, and with my eyes glued to her right hand, Maria proceeded to plunge the pincers slowly and carefully into the hole, the tips of the pincers going at least an inch and a half below skin level. Immediately, the pincers came out again, holding a black object that reminded me of a small burnt sardine just over an inch long, which an assistant took in her fingers and dropped into a bucket on the floor. "Hurting?" Maria asked quietly. The patient mumbled something that sounded rather negative. She was lying stiffly, obviously nervous, but making no sound suggestive of serious pain. Her eyes, unlike Maria's, were open and blinking throughout the operation. Maria wiped the pincers casually on the sheet over the woman's stomach, leaving two clear red marks. She asked for more swabs, and to my total amazement proceeded to press one of them right inside the hole, tamping it down with the pincers until I could only just see the white of the cotton on the bottom of the hole, which looked almost an inch deep. "There," Maria exclaimed, relaxing the tension a little. "Now how are we going to close the hole, eh?" This, the longest sentence I heard her speak on this occasion, must have been for my benefit, for neither of the two assistants made any suggestions. I also kept quiet, and for a few moments Maria just stood there, as if waiting for something to happen by itself. Then, very gently, she began to ease the cotton wool swab out of the hole in the woman's neck. The patient made a few grunts as she did so, and Maria again asked if she felt pain. The reply was a contented "ha" sound. "Say the Lord's Prayer out loud and fix the thoughts on Jesus," one of the assistants ordered unexpectedly. From experience I knew this meant we were at the trickiest stage of the operation. With my thoughts about evenly divided between Jesus and Dr. Dingwall, I hope both will understand. I managed to tag along about half a beat late as the Pai Nosso was recited by the assistants and my colleague. As we repeated the words, Maria slowly eased the swab up and out of the hole, handing it to an assistant, who took it and casually threw it towards the bucket on the floor. She missed, and the stained swab landed a few inches from my left shoe. "Grab it and take it to the lab for tests." I could hear Dr. Dingwall's voice in my ear, but any ideas I had in this direction were dismissed when I caught sight of one of the center's staff members standing right behind me. Lab tests would have to wait. I had seen the swab come out of the neck, enough proof for the time being that paranormal opening of a human body had taken place. Like the first one, this swab had a large red blob on it, and as the assistant had taken it from Maria's pincers right under my nose, I could see it was exactly the same color as blood. Maria bent over the hole. "Look closely," one of the assistants ordered. Now the first rule of psychical research is that when somebody tells you to look at something, you immediately look everywhere else. I did so, first at Maria's face, seeing her eyes still tightly closed, and then at her hands, which had not moved since she had put down the pincers. Then the hole simply closed itself up. That is the only way I can describe it. One moment it was there and then it wasn't. Maria had done nothing at all after removing the swab. I had not taken my eyes off it for more than perhaps 1 second. The assistants had not moved except to hold the palms of their hands towards the hole, at least 2 feet away. The patient had remained motionless as a corpse. But the hole had gone. An assistant reached for a bandage and Maria began to wind it round the woman's neck, muttering in her gruff trance voice that it was all over. Later I learned that this voice was supposed to be that of a well-known Austrian doctor who had practiced for many years in Sao Paulo before his death there in about 1950. A former patient of this doctor, whose name I was given, had visited Maria and been recognized spontaneously. I can only testify that Maria's trance voice and manner were totally unlike her normal ones. "That's all," said an assistant, pushing me gently towards the door. "What was the operation for?" I managed to ask. "Thyroiditis," the woman replied, the tone of her voice not encouraging further questions. We left, after it had been made clear that there would be no more operations for spectators that evening. Out in the street, I immediately asked my colleague to describe everything she had seen. I then did the same for her, and our impressions matched exactly, except that from her position my friend had not been able to see the cotton wool actually leaving the hole, as I had. Neither of us could think of any way deception could have been practiced. Maria's hands had been visible throughout the operation once she had folded back the sheet. She had put neither hand in her pocket. We had both clearly seen the black object emerging from the hole. We agreed on the red spots on the cotton wool and the marks on the sheet. Even if anything had been hidden under the sheet beforehand, we should have been able to spot it. What could have been hidden, anyway? The essential point was that we had both seen a hole in a woman's neck, and we had seen something coming out of it. We had also seen it close itself. Neither of us had any doubt that we had seen a genuine psychic operation at point-blank range. I hurried home in a taxi to write up my notes. One sometimes has difficulty in believing this kind of thing the morning after. 2 days later, I paid a surprise visit to Maria in her home, the address of which I had been given by a friend I met at the center. One of the advantages of São Paulo's, then, woefully deficient telephone and mail systems is that people did not usually mind being dropped in on unexpectedly. Maria was enjoying a quiet Sunday afternoon in her very modest house, which contained nothing but the bare essentials and an ancient TV set, in front of which two of her six children were sprawled on the floor playing toy football. She received me amiably, though she looked tired and had a slight cold. Like many healers, she seemed unable to cure her own ailments. It appears to be a rule that spirit doctors pay little attention to their medium's needs. We sat on the plastic-covered sofa, and after thanking Maria for letting me watch her at work, I asked how long she had been a healing medium. "Oh, it must be about 40 years now," she replied. "It began when I was a girl, about 9 or 10. I used to see visions of a lady in white with a blue sash, and I found that when I put my hands on sick people they would get better." "When did you do your first operation?" I asked. "When I was about 10. It was a man who had trouble with his kidneys. He came to our house and I put my hands on him, and apparently I just opened him up," so Mother told me later. She was terrified. She had been healing ever since, she told me, and had never accepted money for doing what she regarded as helping God's work. I could see no sign in the house of any of the sort of present psychic healers are often given, and which some have been known to ask for. Maria worked every day in a government office from 8 until 2:30, she told me, then came home to attend to anybody who came to see her for help. At least twice a week she went out to work either at the center or at a private house, and sometimes she would go to people's own homes to operate, if they were unable to leave their beds. She always worked with her eyes closed, she said, and had no memory at all of what she did during trance, except a vague awareness of the spirit doctors guiding her. She listened with interest as I described the operation I had seen her perform 2 days previously. 7. Edivaldo. I waited to see Edivaldo sitting on a wooden bench in a ground floor room in Rio de Janeiro that had been converted into a spiritist center. The building stood, or leaned, in a narrow side street of an area full of warehouses, gasworks and run-down bars, the kind of street you end up in when you get lost on the way to an airport. The narrow fatilda section 8 of the building fronted a precarious two-floor construction the demolition squads seemed to have overlooked. Its lower level had been opened up into one long room, with creaking floorboards, a few pictures of saints and inspirational quotations on the walls, and an altar at the far end hiding behind a blue curtain. Nothing could have been less like a surgeon's waiting room. Yet there we all sat, about 100 of us, clutching our numbered plastic fickers, or counters. They were in three colors: green was for a consultation, yellow for a checkup, and pink, of which only 8 were handed out at each session, for an operation. We had been handed our fickers at the door by a woman who had checked our names on her list and asked if we could make a contribution of 30 gruzeros, then worth about £2 sterling. The money went into a plastic shopping bag to be used, she assured us, to buy clothing and equipment for a school in Edivaldo's hometown. On later visits, I was not asked for money, but to bring some children's sport shoes which Edivaldo would give to poor families in his hometown. He was clearly not into psychic surgery for the money. The waiting room was full of the sort of ordinary-looking people you might find waiting to catch a bus. There were men and women, young and old, and quite a few children. Some were obviously in a bad way, leaning on the shoulders of relatives or moaning quietly to themselves in corners. Others looked perfectly well and happy. Nobody complained because Edivaldo was late. We knew he had to drive more than 500 miles from his hometown in the state of Bahia, as he had been doing every other weekend for at least a couple of years. On alternate weekends he would go to Salvador or Recife, always leaving in time to get back to his regular job as a teacher. Finally he arrived, greeted the lady at the door and a few old friends, and immediately went straight to the small hut at the end of the backyard where his assistants were waiting for him. I caught a glimpse of a well-dressed man of medium height with dark hair, spectacles and a neat moustache who seemed unwilling to draw attention to himself. A few minutes later, an assistant peered through the door and called out green fickers 1 to 10. The first 10 for consultation got up and went out into the backyard. The atmosphere was quiet and business-like, with no mass hypnosis, hysteria or speeches. The lady at the door quietly reminded us that Edivaldo's work would be helped if we kept quiet and prayed for him, mentalizing our problems as we did so. I went out into the yard with the next group of 10, and as I waited outside the hut I could hear Edivaldo's voice coming through the open window covered by a thin curtain. He was speaking a mixture of Spanish and Portuguese with a lilting Bahia accent. That would be Dr. Calazans the Spaniard, somebody told me, one of the spirits who regularly worked through his mediumship. Then my group was called into the hut and I was able to get a better look at Edivaldo. He was slightly built, about 40 years old, and had an intelligent and kind expression on his face. He was no crude country peasant, like Arrigatilda cubed. The first thing that struck me about him was his apparent normalness. He might have been a friendly bank manager, for he had a considerable air of authority and self-confidence about him. He was sitting on a chair with his back to a small bed. The only other piece of furniture in the hut was a small table, where a helper was unpacking a paper parcel of bandages and cotton wool. Another assistant held a small tape recorder. Consultations of those in front of me were very rapid. Edivaldo would simply put his fingers on their stomachs and prod around rather vaguely for a few seconds. He would ask patients if they wanted to say anything, though giving the impression he knew what was wrong anyway. Sometimes he would say nothing and just start writing on his prescription pad. He both wrote and spoke at a terrific speed, hence the tape recorder, for patients to check their diagnoses later if necessary, and also for his colleague Firmino outside, whose job was to decipher the prescriptions. He gave me the impression of working frantically against time, as if aware that however many people he treated there would always be more waiting outside. Finally it was my turn. The assistant motioned me forward and I stood face to face with the healer I had heard so much about. My first meeting with him was something of an anticlimax. His left hand went straight to the spot on my abdomen that had been bothering me on and off for 3 years. I began to mutter the Portuguese equivalent of "It's my digestion, doctor. I know. That's where I'm looking," he interrupted brusquely but not unkindly. Then he scribbled off a prescription, rattled off a list of things I should not eat or drink, the same list, incidentally, he had recited for every previous patient, and told me to come back for Unipec A tilde plus minus A operasi A tilde cubed N. A small operation,